Today on New Horizons, the second part of our interview with New York Times reporter Philip Sheenan, author of The Commission, the Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation.
The FBI had in front of it in the summer of 2001 really good clues about what was about to happen. Daily, hourly warnings to Condoleezza Rice that she needed to mobilize the government to respond to it. And she did remarkably little with this information. Our inability to respond before 9/11 is something we need to understand to this day, because nobody doubts there's going to be another terrorist attack in this country someday, and the better prepared we are for it, the better we all are going to be.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. Today we're featuring the second part of our interview with Philip Sheenan, an investigative journalist for the New York Times. He was the newspaper's lead reporter for coverage of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States, also known as the 9/11 Commission. Philip Sheenan's new book, The Commission, the Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, provides an insider's look at how the commission operated as it investigated the most devastating terrorist attacks ever to occur on American soil. Last week on New Horizons, we featured the first segment of our interview with Philip Sheenan. Today, we continue that conversation. Let's get right to the agencies. First, I want to talk about the FAA. You don't spend a lot of time on the FAA, but back to our friend, former Senator Slade Gorton. He takes on the FAA at one point for the most obvious reason that today those of us who go through security at airports can only imagine what they were thinking then, the 4-inch blade and the tip-off list. Help us with those.
Well, Gorton, alone among the commissioners, but Gorton felt that if there was one agency of government that had more responsibility for 9/11 than others, it was the FAA, because the FAA, its responsibility was to keep, you know, commercial aviation safe. And he was startled to discover that the rules of the FAA on September 11th allowed passengers to take on board blades that were up to 4 inches long. And I there's a scene in the book where I describe, you know, the investigators of the commission went out and bought a 4-inch blade that resembled the one that they understood had been taken on board the passenger planes on 9/11 by the hijackers, and passing around this very nasty, sharp blade. And it was clear to anybody who looked at that thing that obviously you could kill or maim somebody with a couple of well-chosen plunges of it. And just the idea that the FAA's rules, especially in the summer of 2001, where there are just a tremendous number of terrorist alerts anyway, the fact that, that the FAA's rules would allow routinely these sorts of blades to be taken on an airplane, he just found horrifying. The tip-off list may be even more horrifying in many ways, because what was discovered was that the FAA supposedly maintained a list of terrorist suspects who would not be allowed onto commercial airplanes in the United States, and shared this with airlines. And apparently its list included fewer than 20 people, when in fact the State Department had a much larger list known as tip-off that had tens of thousands of names on it. And the 9/11 Commission was just dumbfounded to discover that the head of security at the FAA didn't even know that the tip-off list existed on September 11th. It was there, sitting at the State Department, ready for the FAA's use, and it included some of the names of some of the hijackers on 9/11, but the FAA didn't even know that that terrorist watch list existed on September 11th.
Mind-boggling indeed. The FBI. I think one of the most shocking facts in your entire book is to learn that in 2003, a mere 5 years ago, in the Washington, D.C. FBI office, there's only one internet access terminal per floor. That the FBI director under Clinton, I guess, Louis Freeh, actually had the computer removed from his office, almost proudly recognizing and advertising the fact that he didn't need a computer to do business. This all figures in, I suppose, with the FBI's problems tracking down U.S. intelligence regarding these hijackers?
You know, I think if you polled the staff of the 9/11 Commission and you asked which agency of government does bear most responsibility for 9/11, I'm almost certain that the answer would be the FBI. Because the FBI had in front of it in the summer of 2001 really good clues about what was about to happen. You know, most notably, it had under arrest in Minneapolis a guy who looked pretty clearly like a terrorist hijacker in waiting by the name of Zacharias Moussaoui. And Moussaoui, as we all know, had gone to a flight school in Minneapolis, wanted to learn how to fly in very short order, wanted to learn how to fly a 747. You know, his instructor in the flight school takes one look at him and says, and literally within hours says, this guy is a terrorist. We have to get him arrested. And he is arrested by the FBI. But the FBI's information in Minneapolis apparently never really moves to headquarters. Nobody really focuses on it within the bureau. And that's just one example of the evidence that was just sort of blithely ignored by the FBI in the summer of 2001. And you know, the technology is one part of this, which is that the FBI was, and in many ways to this day, has just grossly antiquated technology. In 2001, if you can imagine this, in 2001, when, you know, our kids and grandkids were playing on, you know, daily on the internet, the FBI didn't have a working email system. It didn't have computer scanners. I think there's another anecdote about, I know there's another anecdote in the book about apparently on the evening of September 11th, because the FBI didn't have computer scanners, it had to distribute photographs of the 9/11 hijackers to its field offices around the country by sending them out through the post office. And, you know, as I say, the FBI had lots of clues about what was about to happen in 2001, but because it was just so incompetent on so many levels, it just wasn't able to gather that information in a way that could have allowed them to stop the attacks, even though a lot of people feel the attacks could have been stopped had somebody just paid attention to what was in front of them.
Now, the CIA is much more complicated. I get the impression from your book, I think you say this, there were some heroic people in the CIA who were doing the right things. But then there was also a smoking gun, and the minute Tenet heard about it, he knew that the CIA would, in fact, be held partially responsible for this.
I think, yeah, the record of the CIA is much more a mixed bag, because there really were people at the CIA who from very early on in the mid-1990s understood the bin Laden threat. And there were people within the agency who were absolutely determined to try to find some way to come up with some plan to kill this guy, Osama bin Laden, because they could see what sort of existential threat he posed to the United States that it had to be acted on. A lot of the recommendations, most of the recommendations of those people were not acted on, unfortunately. But indeed, there were people at the CIA who wanted action to be taken on bin Laden and were very smart and left behind a long record, you know, reporting trail as to what they had found. Certainly that stands in stark contrast to the FBI. But the CIA did have just one horrendous blunder that stained its record, which is that it was aware in the year 2000, or at least parts of the CIA were aware, that two Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists had almost certainly entered the United States. These are two of the hijackers who would later go on to live in San Diego,
right,
to get flight training before they participated in the attacks. And apparently this information about the two hijackers, the fact that the terrorists, the fact that they had entered the United States in 2000, apparently that never gets shared with the domestic agencies that could have acted on it. It never gets shared with the FBI, who in the year 2000 presumably could have placed these men under surveillance and even sort of rolled up parts of the plot before it had the chance to take place.
But some of these warnings do find their way into the White House and onto Condoleezza Rice's desk, if I read correctly.
She's at the center of everything, I tell you. She, what happens in the year 2001, I think, is now very clear from the record, which is that the CIA was warning the White House on a nearly daily basis that they were certain there was going to be a major terrorist attack somewhere in the world. They were not ruling out the possibility that it would happen in this country. And the book shows this documentary record, daily, hourly warnings to Condoleezza Rice, who was sort of the gatekeeper of all this information at the time at the White House. She's the National Security Advisor, that she needed to mobilize the government to respond to it. And the record shows that she did remarkably little with this information. She had other priorities. The president had other priorities. They were much more focused on, you know, the question of North Korea. They were question on how to deal with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. They just, for some reason, could not get terribly concerned about these men, you know, sitting in the desert, plotting against us, led by Osama bin Laden. They just didn't seem to understand that threat, even though the CIA and Richard Clark, who was, you know, Condi Rice's chief deputy on terrorism issues, even though they were certainly pounding on the doors in the spring and summer of 2001 at the White House, that something needed to be done. Again, the record shows that very little was done in reaction to their warnings.
And let's talk about Richard Clark. Richard Clark has become somewhat of a media star. Again, for our listeners who may not put that name with the books he's written two books, Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror, and just recently his brand new book, Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. You quote him as bombarding Rice with messages about terrorist threats, and yet, of course, Zelikow then takes off after Clark, says he has a weak grasp of the truth. There seems to be a battle of wills here between Zelikow and Condoleezza Rice. In fact, doesn't Condoleezza convince the White House that she has to testify to respond or rebut what Richard Clark has to say about her not doing anything?
Sure, well, let's backtrack a little bit. Richard Clark is this longtime government bureaucrat who finds his way to the White House in the first Bush presidency. He'd served Republicans and Democrats. He continues on as the counterterrorism director at the White House during the Clinton administration, a job he continues to hold when the current President Bush comes into office. And the record shows that in 2001, on a daily, almost hourly basis, he was flooding his boss, Condoleezza Rice, with warnings that something terrible was about to happen, and that, you know, nobody should assume that this attack, whatever it is not going to happen on U.S. soil. And the record shows that Rice just couldn't get terribly concerned about these warnings. She would dispute that, but I think the record shows that very clearly. Now, the connection with Zelikow is, again, in terms of conflict of interest, Zelikow is on the transition team for President Bush in 2000-2001. And Zelikow's responsibilities for the transition team are to review the operations of the counterterrorism strategy group at the White House. In other words, he is supposed to review what Dick Clark and his team do in the new presidency of George Bush. And Zelikow's recommendation is effectively to demote Dick Clark, to remove him from having easy access to the White House. So Philip Zelikow is the architect of you know, the situation at the White House in 2001 that prevented Dick Clark from getting to President Bush to tell him that he needed to act on all these terrorist warnings. Philip Zelikow is an architect of a part, you know, I think could be argued he's part of what went so wrong at the White House in 2001 in evaluating terrorist threats, and yet it's Philip Zelikow who is then asked to lead the investigation of what went wrong before 9/11.
How would Zelikow explain why he made that recommendation to demote Clark? After all, it is a new administration that is coming into power, and one could argue, therefore, they're entitled to reorganizing and putting their own people in place.
That's all true. And Zelikow's argument is that it just structurally this had been a bit chaotic in the Clinton administration, and they were just trying to sort out, they're trying to end the chaos in the Bush administration. But the effect of Zelikow's recommendation was to demote Richard Clark, to prevent him from getting easy access to the Oval Office, which he had enjoyed in the Clinton administration. And you have to wonder if the world would be a little different today if Dick Clark had been allowed to go to George Bush's office and tell him directly, Mr. President, we face a dire terrorist threat. You need to organize the government to be ready for it. Because of Zelikow's restructuring, Clark wasn't able to do that. All he could do was send memos to Condoleezza Rice.
What do you think of Richard Clark's two books that he's written?
They're fascinating. Certainly his first book, Against All Enemies, was an important resource for me. And I think history shows that, you know, his books are accurate.
And it's not as though he didn't have to take on the commissioners, or maybe I should put it the other way around, because I think I remember in your book that former Governor Thompson decides to take him on in the actual testimony and doesn't do real well.
Well, in 2004, you know, Dick Clark went public. He wrote his book, Against All Enemies, and went on 60 Minutes and, you know, made this very dire allegation against President Bush and Condoleezza Rice, which is that, you know, there had been plenty of warnings of what was coming on 9/11 and that the president and Condoleezza Rice had ignored it. And when Clark went public, the White House went into a panic. You know, they thought this was a real threat to President Bush's reelection hopes in 2004. It was clearly a real threat to Condoleezza Rice's reputation. And they went all out in public and behind the scenes to destroy Clark's credibility. It's not a terribly effective campaign, though, because as the documentary record showed, that what Clark was saying was largely correct.
And so you think today that Richard Clark has managed to hold on to his credibility and his reputation for expertise in national security matters?
I sure do. Yeah, I certainly do.
Okay.
And I'll tell you that a lot of Republicans who know him would say the same thing.
Uh-huh. The president's daily briefing became a central part of the commission's investigation. Help us understand what's called the PDB, how that works in the White House, who prepares it, and what kind of information does it include, and then most importantly, who has access to it?
Well, every day the president and the vice president and a couple of other senior officials in the government receive this document, the president's daily brief, which is sort of a super-secret newspaper that's prepared overnight by the CIA that sort of informs him what are the hottest or most important news developments overnight on a whole bunch of issues. And, you know, presidents going back several administrations have received these things. This issue about the PDBs and whether or not the commission could get access to them became sort of the big showdown between the White House and the commission. The commission said it needed to see what the president, you know, both President Bush and President Clinton had been told about al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda threats before 9/11 so they could evaluate, you know, what the president knew and when he knew it. And the White House initially tried to block all access to the PDBs. This was, again, a long, very public showdown between the White House and the commission. At one point, the commission very seriously considered issuing a subpoena to the White House for the documents that ended with a negotiated settlement in which the commission got access to some of the PDBs, including one pretty explosive PDB that had been given to the president on the August 6 PDB, August 6, 2001, in which the headline of the PDB was Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S., which was a very clear warning, obviously, that the CIA believed that Bin Laden was going to try to carry out some sort of domestic attack.
You're listening to Philip Sheehan. He is a New York Times reporter, and he has written the book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. So what was the reaction of Governor Kaine when he was chairing this commission and finally read the presidential daily briefings?
Well, his reaction, it was interesting. He said he was finally invited into the White House and, you know, was sat down in a classified documents reading room and was finally given copies of these documents. And he said he was terrified by what he was reading when he was finally allowed to see the PDBs because, really, at the end of the day, there was nothing in them. I think he describes them as garbage. They're often nothing more than sort of recycled gossip or what's already been on the front page of the Washington Post and the New York Times. And it sure looked to Kaine like actually, you know, the emperor was wearing no clothes, that the intelligence community knew very little, that the tens of billions of dollars that the United States spends on intelligence every year were largely going to waste.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the Clinton administration and the role that it played in this whole issue of warnings and what they knew and whether they should have acted on it. You open the book with Sandy Berger, the former national security advisor under Clinton, stealing classified documents. Maybe we could begin, why would a guy like that damage his reputation by breaking the law?
Well, it's been this parlor game, or at least it was this parlor game in Washington for a long time. Why would, you know, Sandy Berger do this crazy thing, which is that in 2004, it was discovered that Sandy Berger, who had been Clinton's national security advisor, sort of his top foreign policy aide, had been stealing classified documents that he had been given access to at the National Archives in preparation for his interviews with the 9/11 Commission. And part of my own detective work for this book was trying to figure out why he had done this. You know, why would he be stealing and later apparently shredding classified documents? It turns out that at the end of the day, what Berger was stealing were copies of a particular document, which was a report prepared by this fellow Dick Clark after the millennium period in 2000. And in the millennium, the CIA had been warning that there was almost certain to be a terrorist attack someplace in the world, and it appears that there was apparently a plot to blow up parts of Los Angeles Airport. But anyway, Clark prepares this after-action report in 2000 and distributes it around the government. And Berger seems to have worried that this document, if Clark's after-action report, if it ever found its way to congressional Republicans or to the press, would somehow result in Berger and the Clinton administration being blamed for 9/11. The Clark memo outlined all sorts of things that should be changed in the government in the future in dealing with terrorist threats, and apparently Berger worried that if it appeared that Clark had made recommendations that hadn't been acted on by the Clinton administration, it would look like the Clinton administration had some responsibility for 9/11. So apparently whenever Berger finds a copy of this memo when he's searching through the documents at the National Archives, he puts it in his coat or he puts it in his socks or he somehow gets it out of the National Archives. And he's detected over time. But it's ironic that this was Sandy Berger who was doing this, because in many ways, colleagues of Sandy Berger, and including some Republicans on the 9/11 Commission, will tell you that actually Sandy Berger was one of the people who really got al-Qaeda and really kept the Clinton administration on top of the al-Qaeda threat over the years, that he was one of the people who might otherwise have looked pretty good on the terrorist fighting front.
We haven't talked about the National Security Agency yet, the NSA, and everybody knows the CIA and the FBI. I don't think the NSA is as well known. You've called failure to properly examine NSA records as perhaps the most serious failure of the commission. Explain that.
A lot of people don't realize this, but the CIA is certainly not the biggest intelligence agency in the federal government. The biggest one is the NSA, which is the big eavesdropping agency, which, you know, has spy satellites and it does all the ground-based wiretapping. And it is sort of the source of most of the raw intelligence in the government on terrorist threats and al-Qaeda in particular. And it offered up its archives to the 9/11 Commission very early on in the history of the commission. But the commission seemed to take very little interest in reviewing what was in the NSA archives, even though a lot of people on the staff knew that the NSA was actually the source of most of the, you know, sort of essential raw material on al-Qaeda that the government had before 9/11. And it's only at the last minute that a really diligent staff member sort of insists that somebody go in and start looking through this material. And when they do, they find, you know, some pretty explosive stuff. But it's almost too late to act on it. The commission only has a few weeks left in existence, and there's, I think, a lot of concern among the former staffers that there's a lot of secret information still at the NSA about al-Qaeda and about the 9/11 plot that nobody knows about to this day.
You also write about the commission's findings concerning unconstitutional actions by U.S. officials, more specifically the vice president's role in making the order to shoot down hijacked planes. Is there any doubt at all that he made a unilateral decision without the president's approval? And maybe you should explain to our listeners just what that decision was.
Sure. On the morning of 9/11, Dick Cheney issued an order to the Pentagon to shoot down any passenger plane that approached the Capitol. You know, this is after the initial attacks that morning in New York and Washington. And Cheney insisted repeatedly and vigorously after that he had issued this order only after he had talked to the president and received the president's approval for the shoot-down order. Over time, and this is something that Cheney has, again, repeated, since then, the 9/11 Commission staff, I think I speak for all the ones I've talked to, are certain that Cheney is not telling the truth about that, that he issued the shoot-down order without talking to the president, without receiving the president's approval, if only because that morning it was so difficult for the vice president and the president to talk. They had trouble getting a telephone line. There are multiple logbooks at the White House. None of them showed this communication between Cheney and the president that morning. And it's an unconstitutional, you know, the vice president really has no role in military decision-making. If this shoot-down order was to be given, it was given either by the president or, if the president wasn't available, by the defense secretary, Don Rumsfeld. Cheney's act would have been unconstitutional, and the commission staffers, I think, believed very strongly that Cheney was just not telling the truth about this.
The commission also found that Saudi Arabia most likely provided support for the 9/11 attacks, yet the commission chose not to include all the links to Saudi Arabia in the final report. What were those links, and why were they not included?
Well, I think certainly a lot of the members of the staff who investigated this issue were convinced that there was some sort of tie between officials of the Saudi government and the hijacking plot. And it worked like this. Two hijackers lived in San Diego in 2000. They had lived there to get pilot training, and they had been assisted in all of their sort of logistics, in getting housing, in getting money, in getting social security numbers, and getting telephone lines, by this group of expatriate Arab men who sort of emerged from nowhere to help them. And an awful lot of these men appear to be, in one way or another, on the payroll of the government of Saudi Arabia, including a diplomat working out of the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles. And, you know, the commission staffers aren't alleging that, you know, the Saudi royal family knew about 9/11 or that anybody in Saudi Arabia knew the specifics, or at least within the government knew the specifics of the 9/11 plot, but they are saying that there was some sort of network in Southern California that was linked to the Saudi government, or at least officials in the Saudi government that were aware that, you know, Al-Qaeda terrorists, bad guys, were in Los Angeles and were there to help them. Yet at the end of the day, the commission put very little of this into the final report, mostly because of a debate on the staff. The team of investigators reviewing this issue was led by a very well-respected but very conservative former prosecutor who was determined not to put anything into the report unless he could offer sort of 100% proof of it. And since in this sort of shadowy world there's never 100% proof of anything, a lot of this was left on the editing room floor to the dismay of the staffers. And the 9/11 Commission report was read by a lot of people as an exoneration of Saudi Arabia, when in fact a lot of the staff members believed that there was something very suspicious about what Saudi officials had done in San Diego and elsewhere.
Phil, you've done a masterful job and a great public service, and I recommend this book to so many people as I've been reading it these last few weeks. And no matter how carefully you read it, you come to the conclusion, as you've suggested a couple of times during this interview, there's still a lot we don't know. Are we going to find out? I mean, I don't know how else to say that, but will there be future inquiries? I don't mean commissions, but will there be people like yourself who decide to go back into those NSA stacks and do another take once the Bush administration is in the history books? Does somebody come back and look over those last 8 years, and especially those early years, and see whether or not there still isn't something we can learn from so many people dropping the ball?
I think the answer is undoubtedly yes. I think whatever happens in the November elections, you'll have a set of fresh eyes that go into the White House in January. And they may want to go back and revisit some of these issues, if only because it still obviously has significance today. You know, our inability to respond to pretty clear warnings before 9/11 of a terrorist attack is something we need to understand to this day, because nobody doubts there's going to be another terrorist attack in this country someday. And the better prepared we are for it, the better we are all going to be. I'm sure people go back at this. It's a shame that it appears, you know, that the 9/11 Commission had a real opportunity to settle some of these issues once and for all, and bungled at that opportunity.
Yeah. Well, once again, the place to start is with your book, and again, makes for a particularly good reading right before a presidential contest. The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, by Philip Sheenan. Phil Sheenan, thank you for joining us today on New Horizons.
Bob, thanks so much.
Next week, Stephen Saunders, president of the Rocky Mountain Climate Organization, talking about a new scientific report that documents how the West is becoming hotter and drier. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research provided by Julie Hahn. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.